month, they keep telling that's not enough. An employee's salary is $400. Is it enough? The doctor with a certificate does not find work, as well as the engineer. Are there any projects or hospitals that provide work chances? Let new factories open to help workers find a chance. Is there electricity for factory work? If there were factories and construction projects, no one would need anyone else. We wouldn't need anything from the Israeli occupation, and no one would starve, because when a worker gets a chance, sometimes it's going to be much better than an employee's.
هنا كان في مشروع تطوير البحر وبالتالي توسعة.
There was a project to develop the beach, thus expanding the street by the beach, but the work stopped. Look at this sidewalk. They are supposed to be paving another lane of the street. During the time I spent heading to the office or going home, I used to see many machines, engineers, and laborers working on the project. However, they aren't working anymore due to the lack of construction materials and fuel. This caused the company to stop the development of the street. In addition, many of the workers and engineers who used to work on the project stopped and became a part of the unemployed sector that already existed in the Gaza Strip.
The continuous closure of tunnels and the border crossings does not only exacerbate the high rates of unemployment, it also severely affects the performance of factories, the supply, the local market, with many essential products.
After stopping our work and having it ruined, you can see that we are hunting for work and making a wallet or repairing a bag, just like that. During the past 6 months, we noticed a slowdown in the sectors of clothes and sewing. That happened because of the lack of activation. You can add to this the productive and service sectors. They would be severely affected, and we would go back to the time, before 3 or 4 years ago, when there was great unemployment, a lack of goods and materials needed daily, and a growing crisis in many sectors that would unfortunately worsen the humanitarian and social problems in the Gaza Strip. I was affected anyway. I cannot even fulfill the requirements of my customers or serve their interest. I pack gravel, but I can't do the same with cement. However, there is no cement, and when it is available, I can work with other workers. You can see that nobody works. Cars do not work, or employees either. Some workers come here seeking a chance at work, but I tell them there are no construction materials. If you can bring me any materials in the local market, I am ready to give you a chance at work. I've got the money and the intention. I am also in a hurry. I need to move to my new house. Today we ordered the bricks. The factory said that the bricks are not ready because there is no cement. I have been asking a blacksmith to build me a stair rod. The blacksmith agrees to make me one, but says we should agree on something first. He asks for extra money. When I ask about the reason, he says because there is no steel.
Freezing of small or large projects, the obstruction of industrial facilities, and the increase of the unemployment rate to more than 40% are all considered disasters that threaten to affect a wide range of the population of the Gaza Strip.
I and my sister-in-law were in the kitchen. My son was standing here, and my sister-in-law's sons were there. I was preparing milk for my son, and he was catching my clothes crying. The boiling pan slipped from my hand and burnt it. I should have gone to the hospital, but I couldn't afford it. I didn't have $1 to go to the hospital. I had a bacterium in the blood, and the doctor told me that this infection was caused by a polluted environment. I told him about the condition of our house, and during winter, my house becomes full of water. He said that was the reason. I recently had some analysis and found that I have problems in my chest. The doctor said I need medical treatment, and the prescription contained only two pills that cost $30, and I can't afford buying one. How would I buy those pills? The doctor gave it to me for free once because he knows about my situation. He also treats my patient's son and follows his case. He paid for the medication that time, but how would I afford paying for the rest? How can I buy two pills for $30?
The Palestinians are steadfast and patient people. They have been suffering, but they are aware that the main reason is the Zionist occupation. The occupation has been trying to suppress the Palestinians, but we say that they are patient, steadfast, and will continue to be so. They will keep fighting the occupier with their steadfastness and an honorable attitude opposing these conspiracies. بصموده وبوقفته المشرفة ضد هذه المؤامرات.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. I am your humble, hopefully favorite host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have two brothers in faith and humanity. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, you guys. Would you do a brief introduction?
I'm Muzaffar Haider.
I'm Hassanain.
From the UK.
From India.
So today, first of all, thank you so much, you guys. If I were to meet someone in person, I feel really uncomfortable introducing myself with a title, right? Because I'm Zainab. That's my one and only title. In fact, I am so uncomfortable with titles, I don't even want my children to call me mom. I don't want a title. I don't even appreciate it when people call me by my last name. Is that weird?
You know, I guess it's a mom
thing is weird.
It's weird.
According to the you know, the preference of people. You know, some places they call you with your first name.
Yeah.
And some people call, like, they use your surname to call you.
Yeah, they never call my... I've never been in an environment where people call...
Do you even have a surname?
Haider. Muzaffar Haider. How is that?
But if you... My name brother is Muzaffar. If you were to introduce yourself somewhere, would you represent... Would you use a title to represent yourself?
Never.
Why?
I don't like, you know, I don't like being called by titles and all.
Why?
Like, I just don't like it. You know,
it's what?
Like,
how does it make you feel on the inside? I'm a therapist now.
Wait, are you Sayed?
No.
Are you Mirza?
I'm Mirza, though, yeah.
I even get annoyed when people represent themselves with Sayed. That's not your identity. There are like a kajillion Sadat in the world. What's your name? You know what I mean?
You
have a turban.
I do. For the benefit of the listeners who cannot see me,
exactly.
I have a turban.
Are those who could be in the room and are visually impaired?
Yeah, blind people, yeah.
Yes, definitely. This is a show for them too,
no,
obviously.
Absolutely, yeah.
You wear a turban. Brother Muzaffar wears a turban, and in Islamic culture, he'd be referred to as a sheikh, a mullah, a maulana.
Mm-hmm.
Do you actively try to use any of those titles?
I don't introduce my... Hi, I'm Sheikh Muzaffar.
No?
No. Am I supposed to? Is that a social norm?
Salaamu alaikum. I'm Ayatollah Muzaffar.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody does that really. Even doctors, let's say a doctor, they don't go,
I'm doctor
so-and-so.
They so do.
Do they?
Doctors do it the most. They are obsessed with their doctor. And I get it.
Really?
I get it. If I spent 15 years trying to earn a title, I would rub it in everyone's face too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a doctor.
Yeah, I mean, I guess...
Oh, do you ever actively try to introduce yourself with any of those titles?
I think on posters where... Or, like, where in credits, for example, at the end of a video, if I'm working on a video,
they already saw you wearing a turban.
Sheikh Muzaffar Haider, rather than just Muzaffar Haider. I don't know. It gives it that credibility factor.
Mm.
And I feel like that's really important for a lot of people.
Is it important for you?
Is it important for me?
Yeah.
I don't know. Sheikh, okay, that is my title, right, in social norms sense of the word.
Now, do you prefer being called by, like, Sheikh Muzaffar or just, like, Brother Muzaffar, something like that?
No, I don't like Brother Muzaffar. Now that you mention it, yeah, I prefer Sheikh Muzaffar. Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. It gives a sense of respect.
A respect from you to yourself. You feel obligated now that you're a sheikh.
To do what?
To be more sheikhy.
Yeah, okay, to an extent, yes. Mm. It does change your behavior to an extent. See, it's difficult. I've been talking about this with a lot of people. Where there is this fake behavior that comes about when you, not just when you become a sheikh, quote unquote, but
when you carry a title.
Even when you're trying to be religious or present yourself as anything, you start to put on a certain persona. And I feel like that is detrimental, that persona in and of itself.
Obviously.
Not the title so much.
But your obsession, not you. An obsession with the title is detrimental as well.
An obsession with it, yeah.
You know, there's some, like, in college, right? There's I've had this experience mm-hmm. where I'd call my lecturer, sir, and he'd be like, it's doctor something mm-hmm. something or professor mm-hmm. something something.
See, okay, you can look at that negatively, right? And you can be like, oh, this guy's being arrogant. But you could also look at it in another
the positive
sense,
way, yeah.
Right? Where
exactly.
Maybe they're trying to maintain that level of respect, mm-hmm. that caliber of being in a university environment and for the students
make it
to,
more, like, official?
Yeah, to let the students formal. Recognize that, look, you're at university now, you know? You should have a different respect for us as your seniors here. Because, look, if you're going to university and you're referring to your professor as sir. Mr. So-and-so, for example, or sir, right? That's the same thing that you would do for teachers.
Mm.
But many teachers go and study from
those
university professors, right? So it is, in an academic sense, a level higher.
Mm.
So it makes sense to an extent. I think the problem is when these things become idols.
You're listening to Back to Reality. We're going to be back to reality after a short break, so don't go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Thank you so very much for joining us again on this show. This is Back to Reality. I'm in the studio with my special guests. And our topic is titles. Brother Hasnain.
Yeah, I personally, like, you know, I don't prefer, like, calling myself with titles or giving myself some titles. You know, and I don't mind, you know, people, you know, setting some titles for themselves and people calling them with different titles. Like, if he's an Islamic seminary student, like, calling him Sheikh, Sayyid, or Mawlana.
Mm.
Or, like, if he's a normal, like, you know, academic student, like, calling them engineer or doctor. So the thing over here is, you know, some people, they set a few titles for themselves. There might be a reason behind that, you know, because they feel like that's their achievement.
Mm.
That they have, you know, worked hard for so many years. And finally, they're an engineer, they're a doctor, or they're a lawyer, something like that, or a judge, something. So now, you know, after working for so many years, they prefer to be called as a doctor.
Uh-huh, as a representation of the fruit of their labor.
Yeah. Okay, if you have worked for, like, 10 years, now you're a doctor, I call you a Dr. Zainab. So, like, it feels like an achievement. You finally reached completed what you have achieved your goal.
Mm.
So it might be as a goal for you,
I'm just going to throw this out there. Please refute me if you think that there's more that can be added to it or not. But I think if we're doing it for that reason, then that's where it actually becomes a problem. But if we're doing it not out of respect for an individual,
mm-hmm.
but out of respect for a certain level, whether in academia or in any other place, then it makes sense.
How does it become a problem? Explain that to me.
Because when it's an individual endeavor, I need to achieve this thing so that people will refer to me as sheikh or doctor or PhD or, you know, in military terms, you know, the colonel or captain or whatever.
Well, I feel as, you know, the academic field and the Islamic field, you know, it's like two different things. Because, you know, in Islam, like being an Islamic student, being a Hausa student, it's more like, you know, being, being simple.
See, there's a thing.
Setting out titles for yourself.
Exactly. You know why? Because you wear a turban, you get to be a sheikh.
See, so much of this is down to social norms.
Exactly.
And how much of these social norms are you supposed to fight? How many of them are you supposed to... Not question. How much do you
like in Iran, right? Or even in a lot of Arabic countries, when a person reaches a certain age, they start calling them hajaqa, a man, or hajji. And the man has never even seen the holy Kaaba, never been to Hajj ever in his life.
No, but we call them
hajaqa or
hajji,
hajj khanum,
yeah.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a title we throw around, we give people
because
it's out of
elders.
Respect and like formalities.
Mm-hmm.
But that person has never been on Hajj pilgrimage.
Yeah, it's a sign
it's
of
a
respect.
Social norm. Mm. The same way that a woman might have studied in Hausa for 10, 20 years, no one calls her, I don't know, Sheikha. Oh, in some cultures they do, like in Southeast Asian cultures. Or they call them Ustadha, Alima, Sheikha. But in these Middle Eastern countries, just because she doesn't wear a turban, she doesn't get to be considered as an Islamic scholar. And
you know,
I think that's like sort of whack.
Is there any difference, Sheikh Muzaffar?
I can call you Sheikha if you like.
So is there any difference, like, you know, someone calling, you know, their professor by the name and someone calling their dad by the name?
Yeah.
What's the difference? Like, you know, professors or sir or doctor is a professional title.
Yeah.
And someone calling their parents by the name and not using like dad or mom, like whatsoever.
Well, one of them's forbidden in Islam, right? Islamically, you're not allowed to.
It's unreckoned, detested. It ain't cool, but it ain't unlawful.
Now that you mention it, you can't say that it's haram.
Yeah, it's not haram.
However, that's why I didn't say haram, right? Mm. I said it is against Islamic ethics.
Mm.
It's against that code of conduct that Islam has set out for us.
Sorry to cut you guys off just for a moment. We're going to go on a break and be right back, so don't go anywhere.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
It's against the rights of a father to not to be referred to by his name.
Unless the father prefers it.
Huh?
Unless the father prefers it.
The father is being unjust to himself in that case.
So you said like it's like ethically not correct, right? So the next question arises is like, you know, someone, like, let's take for an example, the same professor, like demanding the students to call him as doctor or professor. And, you know, dad, you know, demanding their children to call him as dad. So now do you say that if professor is demanding his students to, you know, call him as professor, like, is he being arrogant?
Is he being arrogant? Well, it depends on why he's saying that, right? That's why I was saying, if he's doing it for personal reasons, you need to call him because I have achieved this, then yeah, maybe it's out of arrogance. But if he's doing it because he understands that there is a level of academia which deserves to be respected,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to actually help the society, then that makes sense, right? And that's not arrogance. See, titles are a part of human life, and they're mm-hmm. a part of Islamic culture as well. God forbid, you would never say, Muhammad said that. Muhammad said this. No, you say Prophet Muhammad. You say Nabi Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa. Imam Ali alayhi salam. You don't say Sadiq said this. Baqir
said
this.
Okay. Here's
right?
the thing. Here's the thing.
These
here's
are imams. No, I'm taking it from the top down, right?
Yeah, but you were saying that if a father is cool with his child not calling him father, dad, baba, abata, kunpa, ayah, or whatever other languages call their dads. In the case of Hassanayn alayhim as-salam, they called Imam al-Ali Ya Abul Hassan, and they called Rasulullah Abata. It's all a matter of preference.
No.
That's all
no,
the time
no,
we have
no,
with
hold
these
on,
two.
Hold on, no, I got to correct that. Hold on. Because, look, when it comes to the haqq of the children, first mm-hmm. of all, you have to give the father's right, or rather the child's right over the father, is that they get given a good name, they get given a good education, they get married once they're of age, etc., right? The rights of the father and the mother over the child is that they do not, one of them, obviously there's many, but one of them is that they do not refer to them by their names. However, they can refer to them by their titles. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I say to my mom, Sayyida, right? Because she's Sayyid, right? That's acceptable in Islamic terms, right? So calling Imam Ali alayhi salam their father and referring to him as Abul Hassan is acceptable.
Mm.
Those titles in Arabic culture were a kind of prestige and honor in any way.
Ah, oh, I was so hoping I could get you on this because no. I cannot do with mom. I have an identity crisis, but I call my mom birth giver.
But now you can have your child call you Madame.
That's officially all the time we have for today's show.
Okay, so is it okay to not use titles or call someone by the titles?
Yes, I think it's okay. We're literally out of time, guys. Thank you so very much, Brother Hassanayn, Brother Muldafar, and our listeners. Until another greeting and salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him. And he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are trying to look at human rights from the vision and the eyesight of the commander of the faithful Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. We did mention that Amir al-Mu'mineen was trying to build a safe society for people through Islam. The Islamic project to build a safe society in the vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, is represented by several dimensions. That's how Amir al-Mu'mineen looks at them. Perhaps the most important of which are: first, moral and spiritual security, seeking to spread the concept of behavior and piety, because this is the, you know, this is where it all begins, from within us before we move to the outside. And for that, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he says, فَإِنَّ جَارُ اللَّهِ آمِنْ وَعَدُوبُهُ خَائِفْ. For God's neighbors, I mean the believers, are safe, and his enemies are afraid. So even if we live in a troubled world, even if we live in an unfair, unjust world, if we have that piety, if we have that moral values in us, which Amir al-Mu'mineen, he tries to work so hard on when it comes to educating people, he says, if you have that, it means you have Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on your side. If you have Allah on your side, that will give you a sense of safety, a sense of security, first and foremost. You could be in a prison. You could be, I don't know, under a very dictatorship government or severe ruler. But as long as you have Allah, you're safe. But that won't happen until you try to seek and attain these moral values. So the Imam says, first, human beings, they need to have the right to secure the moral and spiritual aspects of themselves. That's the first thing. So they need to live in an environment where they can actually attain and get these things to feel secure. That's the first thing he says. Second thing that Amir al-Mu'mineen works on after moving from the inner, he moves to the outer, and he says, juridical security. We need to live in a world where I know that the court system is fair and just, where I know there are consequences to every action that one does when it comes to stealing and killing and, I don't know, robbing other people and so on and so forth. There has to be a system that guarantees people a fair trial. When it comes to economy, there has to be an economy security. Also from the vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, that needs to be established. Also when it comes to internal and border security of the country itself or the system that you live in, you have to be safe within the borders that you live in. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, even when he looks at, for example, the armies and how he looks at soldiers, for example, he says that it's required. He says they are the soldiers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. فَالْجُنُودِ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ حُسُونَ الرَّعِيَّةِ. Those who are actually in the correct path, the soldiers who are preserving and save the country under an Islamic system, he says they are the soldiers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They're protecting, they become like fortresses for the dwellers of the system, of the people of this country. Now, let us take a break and then inshallah we will continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So we said Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he looks at even internal and border security, he glorifies the soldiers who try to protect and become fortresses of safety for the people that live in such a system or such a government under an Islamic rule. And he calls them and he refers to them as junudun bi'idhnillah, soldiers with the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he says, وَعَزُّدِّينَ, and they are pride and honor for religion. And then he says, وَسَبِيلُ الْأَمْنِ, and they are the way and the path to security. So a system, any system, needs to have soldiers, needs to have military might in order to defeat the foreigners, to defeat foreign armies or those who want to conquer and take over this land. So Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, keep that into perspective. Again, when it comes to safety and security, when it comes to the Islamic way of trying to build a better society, he even looks at external security and establishments of peace with neighboring countries, for example. And it is also a political goal of Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi to have peace with the enemies outside, because you don't want to live in a country where you're constantly threatened by the people around you. He himself says, do not push back a peace that your enemy has called on to you. So sometimes your enemies also, they feel threatened, they call into peace treaty. Come to them, sit with them, and see if you could work something out for the safety and the security of your people. Not to act with arrogance, like we had the First World War, Second World War. Millions of people got killed. Millions of people got displaced, and millions of, refugees and people rights were gone. Why? Just because some countries that were arrogant and they refused, for example, to make peace and come to terms with other nations. So when it comes to Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, that is something that he keeps in his mind. So he says, لا تدفعن صلحا دعاك إليه عدوك. Don't push away a treaty which your enemy has called on to you. And he says, this treaty, that it might have the pleasure and the pleasing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because Allah wants his servants to live in a state of security and in a state of peace. So this is one of the things that Amir al-Mu'minin also looks at when it comes to the human rights. Also, he looks at political and social security. That is something that the human beings need in the Islamic system, of course. So this is the pillars of the Islamic system. We need political and social security that can guarantee that the safety of the human beings that live in such a system as well. So now I have just mentioned the headlines of the system that Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi was trying to establish to people in order to guarantee their safety, to guarantee their security, to guarantee and make sure that their lives are preserved, their rights are also preserved and given to them. Once these pillars are not there, then the human rights and the human life has no more value anymore. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil'alamin, wa ala alin nabiyyi ajma'in, fabihim narjuka ahsin khatmina.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Sabah Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
The police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in it earlier have some experience with the police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, riot gear, and canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's gonna be any change, it starts with our children.
This is gonna be my fighter right here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police, and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves to express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras, right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Richard was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Leek, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism, and that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Mm-hmm. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. Mm. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves was so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and color pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, and that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, it, on the one side, it shows how these people just hit, come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this, the police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that. That sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. Mm-hmm. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And they just, their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that, actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they basically vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add something?
I think what it also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, Muslim, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial
did see
inequality.
A lot of white people in the crowd in support of the black
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch sticker on there. Got some walkie-talkies. It's two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one of my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, you know. And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
You saw David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. He's quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And, of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that moratorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long
a brief break now from the discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who've been fearful for two decades.
It must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about U.S. deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the U.S.?
I think it's largely because of the failure of U.S. Justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017, those are the numbers you expect in a small war somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, It's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and marginalization and it's that system that's carried on.
And people are
just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male, bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world. And it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we much put out. That's how dangerous this man is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camelia Shambiati.
I think I have to mention one of the qualities with respect to the personality of late Sayyid Ja'far Murtada Omeli, that he was truly considered among the scholars who dedicated his life to defend from the Shia.
So that's why we may say that Allama Sayyid Ja'far Murtada Omeli revised the Islamic history from the point of view of a Shia scholar. Allama Sayyid Ja'far Murtada Omeli is trying to criticize the history by compiling this book. I mean, As-Sahih and Siratul Nabi al-Adam.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Ya Mu'allim, peace be upon you, truly you are our teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. The Teacher is mainly concerned with the life and works of the most outstanding Shia dignitaries, jurists, philosophers, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam. And with me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. So, regarding the life and the scholar life of Allama Sayyid Ja'far Murtada al-Omeli, the Shiite biographer and one of the most outstanding famous contemporary Shiite biographers and historians of Islam, it must be said that he had a kind of ijtihadi approach to, we can say, the history of Islam or the study of history. And we could see this one in compiling his book, As-Sahih min Sirat al-Nabi al-Azam. Here and there, so many commentaries have been written about this book, but this book, Sheikh Ziyaniya, has been named as the most outstanding work regarding the Sira of Nabi, I mean the lifestyle or the conduct of Prophet Muhammad, according to the Shia theology or the Shia point of view. What do we mean exactly when we say that Siratul Nabi was based upon a Shiite theology and point of view? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, when we go through the life of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam as recorded in history books, even books that are compiled by Muslims like Tariq al-Tabari and other books,
yes,
we find some stories that these stories are not proper with the personality of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And Allama Sayyid Ja'far Murtada al-Omeli rahmatullah alayh was considering and was, you know, worrying about these problems. That's why he mentions that, you know, none of these stories in the history are not, you know, authentic for us unless we find good evidences for it.
That's why.
So he says we are not relying only on the books, but we are also relying on the evidences. We are trying to find evidences to, you know, solve the problems of the history. So that's why he does not accept the story of, for example, Al-Gharaniq. Also, other scholars, yes, of Shia, they don't accept these stories, but he gives evidences in his book regarding this, that why I do not accept this story and why I believe that,
yes,
such stories are fake.
Okay.
So Allama Sayyid Ja'far Murtada al-Omeli is the person who believes that he should, you know, revive the history of the life of the Holy Prophet and revive the biography of the Holy Prophet. Why? Because he believes that the life of the Holy Prophet as recorded in history books is mixed with fake stories.
Yes.
And he says that I am responsible,
yes,
to, you know, separate the holy life of the Holy Prophet with these fake stories.
Especially when we have the non-Islamic look or the Orientalism,
yes,
you know, look, Orientalist look at the life of Prophet Muhammad, it is mixed with so many fake stories which make a kind of, we can say, unholy, it's better to say, character out of Prophet Muhammad. Something which has been done by the Westerns through the novels and the stories, and just taking a look at it, you know, without referring to the authentic resources. I think when we say reviving truth,